subject matter tonight is the difference between serial thinking and simultaneous logos reasoning. We discussed these in passing other subjects on many occasions, and we've had several requests to define it a little more carefully. So we're devoting tonight to this purpose. And we want to show that serial thinking has a very definite purpose of its own, quite opposite to the simultaneous logos reasoning process. To do this, we'll have to say a little bit about the evolution of man on Earth, the Earth being in the solar system and the solar system in a much larger system. The peculiar thing about man is that today he has reached a level of being able to think serially and to reason serially, and on rare occasions to leap at a kind of simultaneous reasoning process, which he usually calls intuition. A few thousand years ago, the experts differ about whether it's 40,000 years ago or 150,000 years ago or 250,000 years ago. I remember when I was a boy, it used to be 6,000 years ago. Adam was created in the year 4004 BC. We had the word of Archbishop Usher for it. And since then, the scientists and the diggers in the ground, the anthropologists and the geologists, have produced evidences that he must be considerably earlier than 4004 BC. And the estimates have gone up higher and higher and higher. And if we take it in a very simple sense, we can say that once upon a time, the human being was not human in the form in which we now know him. Some of the experts think he was about 5 inches high, with flatulent fingertips, running about the jungles of Borneo. I know some flatulent fingered people today, two of whom are in Borneo, What we do know for a fact is that human protoplasm is in essence the same as animal protoplasm and plant protoplasm also, which means that the living substance, the substance of living beings on Earth, is all chemically very similar. Plant protoplasm, animal protoplasm, human protoplasm are all gifted with the same kind of basic talent. They all have what we call irritability. We have inside our own bloodstream some fun little fellows, phagocytes, which go running about, believing in their own lives and attacking bacteria that get in, gobbling them up as if they owned our body. In fact, they don't know we exist, and they're just minding their own business. And we want to show that man is in a similar position to the universe as these phagocyte chappies are to us. We know as little about the ultimate being of the universe as the phagocyte knows about us. And we have the same kind of problem that they have. If I decide arbitrarily, in the spirit of experimentation, to cut a hole in my integument, the cells in that particular part start repairing it. They have no regard for my experiment. They try to sew the hole up through which I'm trying to peep what they're doing. So they obviously interpret me as a sort of unknown interferer. And we have a similar kind of attitude towards the interference of man's purpose on Earth when a volcanic eruption occurs. We don't know what causes it. It's a simple matter to say it's contraction of the Earth's crust or some kind of processes to do with energy distribution. But the ultimate cause is unknown. Now, in this protoplasmic state to which we've all been before we're born, and some of us have been through sufficient experiments and engramic investigations to have actually experienced what it is like to feel like an unfertilized egg, or a sperm that has not yet fertilized an egg, and also to experience what it is like prenatally to go through various phases of being. And we all know that when we are quite little, we have great difficulty in differentiating between different types of stimuli. After we are born, we have a great deal of difficulty in trying to find some sort of reason for what our parents do, because what they do is very peculiar. And we don't seem to be equipped at a very early stage of life to be able to discriminate between all the different things that happen. And we know that as children, it is very difficult for us to distinguish between our waking consciousness, the external world, and the dream consciousness, a process going on inside us, which frequently gets projected into the external world, so that we as children are not quite sure what is objective reality outside and what is subjective reality inside. And this difference between subjective being and objective experience is the subject matter of what we're talking about tonight. Now, if I imagine for a moment that this paper represents the power, substance, of the universe, something like Einstein's unifield, except differing from Einstein's unifield in that he defines it in a more limited way than we do, and his version of it is already under severe attack because of certain limitations it has produced. What we do know is that matter is force. We know that there are no material particles in the world that are not fundamentally force patterns of a field. A field, like a body of water, or like the plane of this paper, which is undulating, and in the process of its undulation, it is producing patterns. Now, if I wave the paper, and we watch very carefully, we can see by the play of light on it, the change of chiaroscuro, the light and shade, that various waveforms are passing through the paper, some quite little ones, some severe ones, all the product of this main movement. So if I move this in an undulating manner as far as possible, although I move it in a large way, little tremors can be seen appearing within it, so that the main undulation, which we could represent like this, is producing subsidiary movements like this, and on top of those, smaller ones still. So if you like to take this undulation of the paper and watch very carefully, first see the big movement, then focus on a particular portion of it, and watch the undulation from there, you'll see smaller waveforms appearing. And then if you focus down to a smaller one still, you'll see tiny little tremulations. I think those can be seen. They can be seen by me, possibly, because I'm near it. Most of you will lend your active imagination to it and realize that if you make the whole paper undulate, we have made all the parts of the paper undulate also. Now, we want an explanation of the universe from one concept. We want only one concept, because if we have two concepts, we will have to account for the relation between the two. And the concept we have is the concept of sentient power. That is, a power that feels itself. A power that is able, when it undulates, to feel that it is undulating. If we do the same thing with a muscle, we contract the muscle and feel the contraction, and we feel that contraction of a muscle is different from extension of the same muscle. So in our own being, we have an illustration of a power that can feel. Our organism feels its own movement, and it does so as a derivative talent from the fundamental field of power that generated the universe. So if I now draw a wave in this manner, call it like a fundamental wave from the material end, and examine the vibrations of this paper a little more carefully, I will find that it's waving along like this, and on top of each of those little undulations, smaller ones still. Now, these very tiny ones are primary quanta of energy, impulses in the universe, and we can imagine that the build-up of this pattern in reality is exactly the opposite to the one I just drawn. I've drawn a long wave first, and then smaller waves upon the pattern of this long wave, and then smaller ones still. And if we examine the way the sea develops a long wave, if we go and watch the sea when it's calm, wait for the wind, and see what happens when the wind first comes to that water, it produces on the surface of the water a high frequency ripple. And if the wind continues to blow, gradually the surface of the sea begins to undulate with a longer wave. And if it continues to blow, it will gradually build up with the continuance of time and the increase of power, a larger wave. So that when we actually observe the behavior of a body of water like the sea, we find that the high frequency waves predate the longer frequency waves. Little tremulations come first. Now if we apply this in the realm of physics, we know something about high frequency. High frequency has power to disrupt lower frequencies. We can do things with ultrasonics. Today we can use ultrasonics like a surgeon's knife. We can use ultrasonics to melt metal. A high frequency wave can actually operate on a lower frequency structure and disrupt it. So we have to think in terms of the high frequencies being really more powerful. Now supposing we say that when the wave occurs, the sentient power which is moving in that wave is experiencing its own motion, and we then apply a time unit to it. Supposing we say 1 second is taken to observe this half wave, and we decide we'll increase the thing and make a proper cycle. When we observe this wave, a depression and an elevation, a trough and a crest, in this way, if we observe this in 1 second, we have observed a pattern in which a convexity looking from above is matched by a concavity, which would be a convexity if we look from below. And when we get this long wave in this manner, in the field of sentient power, then the per second is very, very slow. But if we keep doubling up the waves, and say that each one of these waves is an impulse that is experienced by consciousness itself, by the sentience of the field, then we say the higher the frequency, the more we perceive per second. We can say then that if we sharpen our consciousness and observe very, very carefully with sharp attention, we are actually using a higher frequency energy than if we are half asleep and not paying much attention. And what we know about all religious systems and the best psychological systems is that they say that the power of the consciousness in its fully developed form is able to penetrate into states of consciousness that would be unknown to somebody working at a lower intensity. Now imagine for a moment that we have a primary ripple running through infinite space. And this primary ripple, the absolute one, we could use the Greek letter alpha for it. In the Kabbalah they use aleph, which is the Hebrew equivalent of alpha, and say that this represents the absolute top frequency in being, and therefore the absolute top consciousness. But we observe a very funny thing about it. There is nothing higher than it to observe it. It is a consciousness which has no observer of itself, nothing above it. This is the absolute. So if we have only this highest of all frequencies, this alpha frequency, and there is no lower frequency, then there is no objective world inside it. It is a pure consciousness with no object. Now this is an absolutely fundamental idea, so we'll examine it again very carefully. We're talking about the seeming frequency of pure universal being or absolute being. We're giving it the name Alpha instead of the more unfamiliar Hebrew Aleph. Everybody knows Alpha. And we're saying that because of this sentient power experiences itself and its own undulation, then the top frequency, if it were there alone, and this means the first frequency, the original frequency, would have no objective content, because the feeling experience of this undulation would be identical with itself. It would be like a pure consciousness of a human being in total darkness, with no object. He would feel, if you like to do this experiment, go in a dark room, don't lie on the bed, because if you do, you will feel the pressure of the clothes or the bed beneath you, and this will give you an objective consciousness. So if you want to do this particular experiment properly, you must naturally levitate. Just float about in the air so that there are no pressures upon you, and then magic command all the air to disappear, so the little molecules of air don't beat on your body and give you an objective content. Now if you manage to do this experiment first time, we like a little objective account of it, and if you do, you will comprehend what it means to be a pure, absolute consciousness with no object. Some sort of approximation to this has been done in the preparation of astronauts for their interplanetary travels. These men are put in special suits and they're floated in water and they are blindfolded and they are earplugged, and then they are asked to watch what's going on. And usually they find fantasy is going on. Not nothing is going on, but something is going on, because this being participating in the experiment is not nothing, he's an energy system. And therefore the energy inside this being is presenting him with fantasies. And instead of thinking about nothing, he finds that peculiar things are happening in his mind. And if we don't condition this fellow with suggestions beforehand of what kind of things to expect, like an attack of insanity or Aldous Huxley's dreams of heaven or something of this order, then he experiences the replay inside his being of all that he has experienced that has been engrammed in his protoplasm, and he goes into a state of fantasy because there is no external objective control upon him. Now he's beginning to approximate to this high frequency. But of course he's a very long way away, because he's still a material being. At this level of the absolute, the consciousness has no object unless it deliberately induces in itself lower waves. So we say the other frequency here is the highest, and then if this one induces in itself another wave, but still with the olive one on it, because that one cannot be got rid of, because it is the property of sentient power itself, so to vibrate, when it produces this wave of the second order, I think we better call olive zero, because this always fools people. The first is nil, and the second is number one. It's good metaphysics, but very confusing. When this happens, then the top frequency, the Aleph, becomes aware of another frequency, the longer one, and this second one becomes an objective state to it. That is, it becomes aware of something other than its primary vibrational state, and that of which it is aware is now a content of consciousness. Very technically, as we shall see later, it isn't really objective, because we use the word objective in a very special way. But now, if we take a third one, we'd have to get a large wave, as we've done. Put the olive one on this. And here is our second one, and here is the new one. Now this third wave, that is to say the second, is producing a second level of being. And it is a longer wave, lower frequency experience. So because it's a longer wave, there are fewer impulses per second, and therefore it has less energy per second. Now if we go on lowering the frequency in this way, we can produce a certain number of frequencies getting longer and slower all the time. Now I started with this one at the bottom, thinking in terms of pulling this paper down. If I thought of it in another way, I would have to say, I should have started that one up there, and the second one here, below it, then the next one, this becomes of course increasingly difficult to do all these wiggles, and then another one down here. And I get a series of frequency bands, each one with its own experience, each level with its own feeling state, and each higher level is subjectively observing the lower level, and the lower level is unaware of the presence of the higher level. When we come to consider the nature of the unconscious mind, we will see that the real name for the unconscious mind of psychology is the superconscious mind, because certain things are going on in that mind far more quickly than occur at the intellectual level. Imagine we are decreasing the frequency, but always the top frequency is on, the zero frequency, the other frequency, then we have another frequency. Let's do it in English. We'll say the A frequency, and then we'll say the E frequency, and we'll say the H frequency, the K frequency, and the Q frequency. These particular letters are used for these frequencies because the letters have specific significance. Just as science borrows letters to signify certain concepts, like you might borrow a Greek letter equivalent to M to represent substance, you might borrow E for energy, and so on. So in this particular archaic system, we are using an original symbology. A equals the absolute, E equals the universal, we'll show what that means in a moment. H equals the individual within the universal, but head of a lower form, which is the intellective or rationalist form of serial man, and below that the sexual impulse of man. Now, I will try to represent it here in a slightly different way. I'm going to draw a line across here to separate the A from all the other levels, because the A is an absolute and cannot cease to be, but the others are relatives and can cease to be. In physical science there's a law called the entropy law, and in this law all the energies of the universe which are in a state of disequilibrium are in process of winding down into a state of equilibrium, and when they reach that perfectly balanced state, then apparently there is a perfect balance and there is no objective content in the universe. For instance, the Earth is quite a heavy planet, actually. Jupiter is a big planet, but its mass per cubic foot is not like that of the Earth. The Earth is very solid. Now we know that matter is force, and we know therefore that the Earth has condensed a tremendous amount of energy into a relatively small planet. And therefore we could say that the Earth is a representative of what we call ectopy, that is, the objectification, the compression of forces to produce an object within consciousness. If we were to take all the energy of the Earth and spread it, we might do this by putting a Bunsen burner under it and raising its temperature and expanding it, turning it from a solid into a gas, and then raising the temperature further, it would incandesce, turn into a sun, raise the temperature further still, and it would then dissipate itself to infinite space as an equably distributed light. which was its origin. Now, when it was equably distributed, its energies, we would say it had reached maximum entropy. It could not spread itself out anymore, but the energy that is here gathered together in the earth would not have ceased to be, it would simply be spread out. Now the whole universe has been built by the pressing into centers of field forces. Every planet, every sun, every star is a center of condensation of field force. So one thing cannot cease to be, and that is the ultimate force, the Aleph force of the Absolute. All the others can die down and go into a state of balance, but this Absolute One cannot cease to be. And this is why in religious philosophy we say that there's one thing that God can't do. He cannot cease to be God. He cannot get rid of himself. Now let's consider for a moment, all the other distributions of force are relative. Only the top one, the Alpha, is absolute and indestructible. All the others below are relative, and they are levels of being. We can draw lines between to represent these levels, and we've got Q at the bottom, Aleph at the top, and three other levels between. Now we have to remember the significance of these letter symbols, and we're going to apply this in a slightly different way. I'm going to start at the bottom now, and I'm going to write the letter Q again, and point out that this letter Q was once sacred to the goddess Venus, who was the goddess of terrestrial reproductive processes, of father and mother activities and childbearings and so on. She is used to represent the material world and therefore the physical body. So I'm going to write physical body on here. I'll put Phys Bob to say writing the full words. Now the physical body we know we've got, and if anybody is too sceptical about it and denies that he has one, we can usually provoke a reaction by kicking him smartly on the shin. I haven't yet met a man who, when he denies the evidence of his senses, has had quite enough self-control to inhibit a slight cry when smartly kicked on the shin to demonstrate objectivity. I've heard many men, including certain solipsist friends of mine, who don't believe that we exist, and each one believes that only he exists, a smart kick on the shin has to be accounted for within his philosophy, because apparently some fantasy has produced another fantasy called pain, which he finds it difficult to inhibit. Now, above the level of the physical body, we are putting K down here, and this letter we're going to use to represent life force insofar as it is a closed system. I'm just going to start the lines of this circle going out again, because we have to remember all derives from absolute energy. This K means a closed system, and it is the life force in the body. We have a physical body, which is just like the physical bodies lying about outside in the garden on the path that we normally call stones. Our physical body is made of terrestrial chemistry. And terrestrial chemistry, ordinarily, without the life force permeating it, lies about on the ground. And of course it's a very good job it does, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to rely on it to walk on it. It's very, very important when thinking about the doctrine of equality, not to be overthrown by it and lose one's sense of hierarchy to the point of lecturing stones to demand freedom, to the point where they actually respond and get up and run away. We have to allow them to occupy their humble station, otherwise we can't walk. But the energy inside those stones, manifesting as minerality, is the same type of energy essentially as manifests in our physical bodies. We can talk, actually it's a misuse of the word physical frequently, because this word physical implies growth. And in physiology we can see that the fish part is correctly used, whereas in physics it is really incorrectly used, unless we remember that all forces are absolutely alive. When we come to the closed system here of the life energy, we must now imagine that inside the physical body and permeating it, there is a life force. This life force appears in the living physical body as a biomagnetic field, and it is experienced by us as a feeling of being. For many problems, we don't bother to go above this, because this is practically sufficient to explain the behavior of most bipeds on Earth. And many philosophers and scientists especially believe that this is all we've got, a physical body and some kind of life force in association with that body, permeating that body. And if we remember that the frequency of the life force is higher than the one of the physical body, we see that the higher frequency can permeate the lower one and produce changes in it. These changes in my physical body I experience as changes produced by wishes, wants, desires, inclinations, and so on. So if I feel like closing my hand, my hand will close. And if I feel like opening it, and there are no restraining forces, it will open. And I'm doing this because I am a living being. And I don't need any other higher explanation to account for the fact that if I itch, I might scratch. There is something about the balance of forces in a living being that results in adjustments whenever a stimulus comes. So if we go to the zoo and we watch the monkeys, we will find that they are busy doing things, because energy distribution is stimulating. And whenever a stimulus occurs, a reaction tends to occur with it. So that when we are describing a living organism in terms of pleasure-pain responses, we are using only two levels, the physical mineral level and the life force level permeating it. If we like to analyze the behavior of the plant world and the animal world, we can see that most of its behavior is based on the irritability of the protoplasm. We know that an amoeba, for instance, will move towards a food particle in the water. And we know that if we drop a little lemon juice near it, with a certain saturation, it will shrink away from it. So it evidences what we call a toxic response, positive toxism if it moves towards the stimulus, and negative if it moves away. If it moves towards it, we say by analogy with our own behavior that it is having a pleasure from it. If it tends to move away from it, we say it's a displeasure. So we can explain a tremendous amount of behavior, even of human beings, in terms of pleasure pain. Most people do what they like, and they avoid what they dislike as far as they can. Doing what we like and avoiding what we dislike is just being one level above the mineral world. A plant, when it grows with its leaves towards the light and the air. All its growth is determined by a certain ratio to spread out its leaves to find maximum light and air for its leaves. The roots, however, have another kind of toxism. They're hygrotoxic, they move towards dampness, which they need. So this same entity, this tree, is growing above its waistline towards light and air, and below the waistline, it's growing down towards mineral salts in solution in water. The same behavior that occurs in the plant, that is the movement towards what it wants and needs for its being, towards light and air, and in the roots down to moisture and mineral salts. The same behavior appears in the animal, slightly more refined. The animal doesn't just grow towards the thing, it runs towards it, and it doesn't just grow away from it, it runs away from it. If you watch a chameleon catching a fly, and you take a cine film of that chameleon, and then play it back in slow motion, it will look exactly as if the tongue, which is quite a long thing, it's a small little animal, appears to be growing out of its mouth towards the fly. Now, it is only a matter of the relative speed. It is only a matter of the relative speed of observation whether we think this tongue is growing or being mobilized. If we thought it was growing, we could say it is a vegetable response. If we think it is actually self-mobilized, we can call it an animal response. In certain states of consciousness, we can actually observe a relatively fast motion of the waking consciousness, slowed down, and then it looks like growth. We know that this kind of thing occurs in the embryonic development of a human being. When this egg begins to differentiate, it grows a little knob, and another little knob, and some other little knobs, and these become the beginnings of limbs. And it gradually extends these limbs by growth, but the growth is actually a mobility of the protoplasm. And because it is changing its form and has a term, a target if you like, namely the growth of the human arm and the extension and culmination of it in the fingertips, we can think of it as growth, although in actual fact there has been in this growth a mobility which, if we observed it taking place very quickly, we would classify it as an animal response. So with this K level, we are going to say the life force, the yogic term for that is prana, and we know by experiments this life force comes primarily to the earth from the sun. We know that if we deprive the earth of solar radiation, the vegetable world will disappear. We know that the plant world has been conjured out of the mineral of the earth by solar radiation, and therefore we can say the life force is the same thing as the sun force. And if we understand that several thousand years ago the priests worship the sun because it caused growth, then we can understand that sun worship was not quite as silly as some anthropologists have suggested. You can do a very simple observation here to show the power of sunlight. If you examine all the different types of bacteria that grow in the dark, you will find that those bacteria are very simple forms, like little dots and sticks, and they build themselves into chains and so on. But they've got a very rudimentary form. They don't seem to go beyond the dot and the stick and then build chains out of them. But as soon as we come to examine life forms that have grown in sunlight, we find highly complex structures in which very often a triangular or a double triangular form and radial forces show themselves. And they show themselves in those life forms that have actually been radiated by sunshine. So we can see, whereas in the mineral world growth is by crystalline projection, injection, we say that the crystal grows from outside itself by accretion, at the level of the life force the energy is taken in from a higher frequency, is changed in its frequency and pushed outwards towards the integument, the skin. So if I put cake in the cake hole here and drop it down into the tummy and break it down into primary energy wavicles and then distribute those in my body up to the inside of my skin surface and permeate the skin to keep it alive, I'm taking energy in from outside, changing its form and pushing it out to build my being bigger and bigger. I have had an energy, basically an external radiation, and practically the whole percentage of it to us living beings on earth comes from the sun. Very little gets to us effectively from the planets and the stars. We know that the stars supply a bit, but it's very minute compared with solar radiation itself. This energy comes into us, changes phase, is pushed out to our skin limits when we grow. If we like to explain beings of the organic order, that is the living order, we can say that they grow in the opposite way to the physical or mineral bodies. The mineral body grows by simple accretion, like a crystal. The organic, living body grows by taking energies in, disguised as food, breaking the food down into energy, changing its form and packing on the inside of the body and pushing the integument of the body out, and thus getting larger. And we can explain most of the behavior, all the behavior of the plant, all the behavior of the animal, and a large percentage of the behavior of human beings, to misuse the word, of mankind would be a little better, in terms of I like it and I don't like it. And many philosophers have said that we don't need any other concepts. We can explain all human behavior in terms of toxic response, that is, in tendencies produced by energy conformations to move towards certain types of stimuli, that is, energy input, and away from others. And the rule is a very simple one. If the system can take the energy in without being disrupted, we can think the system has eaten that energy. And if the energy comes too fast for the finite being to take it in, the finite will be disrupted, and we say it can't take it. It can't assimilate it. Now, because it's a sentient being, it is feeling. If it can actually assimilate this energy coming in, it feels very pleased, because in taking this energy in, it is now a bigger and better and stronger and more intelligent being than it was before it took in this energy. So we feel better when we've had a meal after being hungry than we did before we got it, especially if we eat it sufficiently slowly not to upset our digestion. If the energy is put into us too fast, like certain kind of German people who force feed geese with a pump, and they just put food in the end and wind the handle, it drives it down and the goose expands for Christmas. That kind of thing is very difficult to assimilate, and there's a great deal of displeasure and pain in the recipient organism. But we can explain most of human behavior in terms of I like it, I dislike it, in any situation. But as long as the human being is functioning at the level of the life force only, he is no better, really, than a plant, except that he can run about like an animal. So it's as good as an animal with a plant involved inside it. He can respond to a stimulus, move towards that which he can assimilate, away from that which he cannot. If he can't get away, he is destroyed. But there is another process, the one we're using at the moment, because it's quite certain to me that I'm not doing something under a life force, because what I'm doing is not dictated to me by a mere pleasure or pain. There is another process going on inside it. The kind of attention that we're giving to this subject matter is not the kind of attention that we will get from our favourite poodle, although poodles are quite intelligent. We cannot get this kind of response from an animal brain that we are giving at the moment to this subject matter. So we have another kind of process above the level of the light force, and we will deal with it. And we remember, we use the H letter for this one. Before we examine it, I would point out that what most textbooks call reasoning for man is really toxic reaction of pleasure-pain. Most reasoning processes are conducted by I like it and I dislike it. Some people have said that the K letter represents the intellect or reason, because there is an evaluation taking place. But as the evaluation is determined entirely by the character of the stimulus and the structure of the receiving organism, it is really entirely outside the control of that being. And we reserve the word intellect in its proper sense for a higher level of being. Here we have the mineral body permeated with life force reacting on I like it, I dislike it. Now above this level, we've got the level represented by H. At this level, a new method of evaluation is coming in. Instead of going by like it and dislike it, we go by the realization that we can be tricked by liking and tricked by disliking. There are very many clever men on a place in Blackpool called the Golden Mile who sell fairy floss. And I saw a little boy sitting in the bus just near the door, and his mother had just brought him a great piece of fairy floss. And he was absolutely fascinated by this, and his life force was looking forward to a very large meal and a lot of enjoyment. And he tore off with his primitive paw a large piece of fairy floss, and he put it in his mouth, and I watched him, and of course it disappeared. And he champed and suddenly burst into tears. Where had this magnificent substantial treat gone to? There was a tiny little bit of sugary water in his mouth, and he couldn't quite find it. Now, this type of experience is essential to carry us from the like-dislike level to a higher level of discrimination. We discover that the world is full of fairy floss, and we learn to distrust it. So on the next level, we say, we need an inhibitor on the pleasure mechanism, and we need a kind of spur to push us towards a painful situation. And if we can't inhibit our pleasure response and drive ourselves towards an unpleasant or even painful situation, then we're going to function at this lower level of being deceived by fairy floss every time. Now in psychology there is a little law, you know, they make laws when they're doing science of various kinds, called the law of the persistence of error. And the law generally in science simply means that people will keep on doing the same thing. So we might as well call it a law. And the law of the persistence of error was devised to account for the fact that even grown-ups keep putting fairy floss in their mouths and then bursting into tears when it disappears. One of the most obvious fairy flosses is the one called happy marriage. Now, at this level of the H, we see the symbol, this letter H derived originally from a ladder, and it's a matter of economy. And this ladder was once drawn like this, with lots of rungs on it. Ideally, we ought to have 8 rungs on it, and we'll see why later. The octave, the H letter is the 8th letter of the alphabet, and was symbolically used by the Egyptians to symbolize hierarchy or differences of power arranged with the top powers at the top and the bottom powers at the bottom. Now, to do this, the being at the H level has to go against things that please him, and he has to go towards things that are painful. If he can't drive himself to do this, then really he is no better than the mere biological reactive being like an amoeba. Slightly better mobilized than an amoeba because it's grown its pseudopodia out and stuck bits of mineral salts and made bones and made itself a skeletal system. And there's no difference in principle between the amoeba in the pond and the animal running about. All that the animal has done, the vertebrate animal, has deposited mineral salts inside itself and made itself a skeleton so that it won't automatically contract into a little sphere again. Some of the animals, like the crabs, have deposited it on the outside. But whether deposited on the outside or the in, the only essential difference between the animal and the amoeba is the greater mobility of the animal. At this H level, which is a higher frequency still, a man can decide to make himself do something unpleasant. He can actually resist the tendency to buy, like the little boy who had the fairy floss said, when I am 21,
I shall buy all the fairy floss in the world, corner the market, and eat it myself. He can resist this tendency, and he can compel himself to do something horrible, like studying German declensions, because he's got his eye on a girl in Germany. Now, when we are pursuing purposes at the H level, we know very well that the men on the Golden Mile have set up a lot of traps for biological beings, beings driven by liking and disliking, and that if we stay at that level, these Golden Milers will undoubtedly dupe us and give us fairy floss in exchange for real hard cash. So we build up here a system of inhibitions, so that the H level man is very clever at inhibiting things. He can inhibit a spontaneous grab at something pleasant. He can inhibit the tendency to run away from a painful situation. You might remember that when Wellington was shaving before Waterloo early in the morning, and some young officer ran in and said the enemy had started the action, he didn't bother to turn around, he just finished shaving. And this is the kind of thing that convinced the young officer that he had the right fellow in charge. Anybody who can inhibit a tendency to run out on being presented with a stimulus of danger is in a better position in terms of human response than a man who, on hearing danger, danger, promptly cuts his own throat with his razor blade and then curses. Now, all the so-called great leaders of men have got this one thing in common over what they would have called the herd. That is, the mass response, the electorate during the election time, function on liking and disliking, and the gentlemen above them who are going to misrepresent them after having received their votes, have to inhibit themselves and keep their mutterings and complaints very low during a little election thing not very many months ago. I was doing a bit of scrutineering with some friends and observed that some of the forms were very badly filled in, so that the cross was made on a line between a conservative and a liberal. And there was a certain conservative gentleman there who looked at it and said, "What the hell do you expect from these people, really?" And he picked it up, looked at it and said, "Put it with my lot." This was his personal evaluation of the election. Now, this is the H level. In Germany, they call this H level the Het Man. You might as well spell it, because it's a good way of doing it. A Het Man is the same thing as a Headman. And you know that your brain and nervous system have a very peculiar function in the body, and if most people knew what it was, they'd have it taken out immediately. Because it's there to stop you going for pleasures and to force you to get up in the morning and go to work when you don't want to. The brain and the nervous system are inhibitors to stop your life force functioning when it wants to. And without a brain and nervous system, you could not trap these living beings to getting up until morning and to sacrificing themselves for causes. After having read an advertisement that says, "And we guarantee that at least 10% of the money collected for this charity will go to the purpose for which it has been designed, and the 90% shall be used for administration." This level is called the Hetman. And in the old lips of this Hetman, he is represented as carrying a ladder, scala perfectionis, or how to control yourself. Now, a ladder has several functions, and the letter H, the eighth letter, comes from a word which is the same word as hedge. And you can arrange your ladders, if you've got three ladders, it's quite useful, you can arrange your ladders like a little defense method to surround a field and then put your sheep inside it. So if you've got a ladder, you can surround an area You can saw your ladder into three bits, right? And surround it, or you can get yourself three separate ladders. In fact, all the ladders in the world are really bits of a very big ladder that got sawn up a long time ago. Now, this Hetman level is the ability to make hedges. But the funny thing about this ladder, it's an all-purpose sort of thing, and you can use another ladder, leaned against the other three, for climbing over the one you've made. So having put the sheep inside it, and they don't know of this ladder lock, so they don't immediately set to pieces and make ladders by plucking grass and things like that, and there's weight. And when you're ready, you come along with your little ladder, in fine style, you climb over and select a nice fat one, cut its throat, take it home and eat it. Wherefore, saith the Lord, I have loved Jacob more than Esau. Esau didn't know how to make ladders. Now, another thing you can use a ladder for, of course, is bridging a gap. You can put your ladder over there and run across it. So a ladder has many functions. You might remember some of your measurements. Most people can't remember these measurements because they were done at school. One rod, pole or perch. Does anybody know how long it is? Mm. It's a piece of wood that was used as a rod for hitting people and for measuring things. And if you had a pallet, it could perch on it when you weren't using it. And it was also used as a ridge pole to build a straw house. So in the same thing, if you bother to remember the length of it, you'll find it's quite convenient at that length for these three functions. And this level of using the hedge, that is the control, that is the inhibiting power, on your pressure plane life force response, means that if you are able to do that, you can certainly boss an awful lot of people about if you feel so inclined. Hitler was a typical hetman, and he looked upon the German people, remember he was an Austrian, Austrians don't like Germans, as so much gunpowder that he could use, and he had to make hedges to keep them in, and made these hedges with words called propaganda. Now this Hetman level would like to own all the sheep and all the bull cows and other things, everything that's runnable about. He would like to put them in fields where they're convenient for him and surround them with hedges, and also with a peculiar kind of bipeds that the Hetman believes are subhuman. Now, he has a very good ground for believing they're subhuman, because they are. That is to say, they're not thinking in terms of power. When we use the word man, this word shouldn't be in this section, it should be down here, but we'll leave it here. We're using a word meaning to evaluate and to count. And it is quite correct to say that any being whatever that evaluates or counts is a man. And therefore, any being that shows a reaction to a stimulus is a man. Because it reacts to a stimulus differentially. It doesn't react to an excessive stimulus in the same way that it does to a mild one. And because its reaction differs for different stimuli, we can say it is evaluating it. So we can say, William Blake said, even the grain of sand is a man, because when you hit it, it reacts. And differential reaction is man behavior. But the Hetman says, I am a power evaluator. So he considers himself superior to mankind. And this is a very important distinction, that mankind is the same thing as saying herd evaluation. Kind equals herd. Man equals evaluation. Mankind are herd evaluators, but human beings are power evaluators. And the power evaluators are one up on the mankind beings, because being kind, defined by the Hetman as mere sentimentality, being kind at the level of the life force means aggregating together in groups. You know that when deer are being pursued by a lion, they tend to run together in a block. And the strongest and most intelligent seem to be running faster, and they're at the front. The duller-witted and the weak and the sickly, they're hanging about in the rear and on the flanks. some people think this is a dispensation of God, that the lion is employed for thinning out the weaklings so that only the best can breed. Actually, of course, it simply means that they're more intelligent and stronger, and they get to the front, and therefore they don't get eaten. Now, when we evaluate power, and we are able to inhibit ourselves, we are human. If we can't inhibit our pleasure, pain responses, we are not human. We are man, because we can tell the difference between pleasure and pain, and therefore we evaluate. But we cannot claim to be human until we have the power to inhibit. So the frequency in the mind that has the power to inhibit biological liking, disliking responses is really a higher frequency order of consciousness. When we're dealing with, say, congenital idiots, they haven't got this great power of inhibition. And people that teach congenital deficient know that they have quite a lot of time spent not in teaching, but in diverting these children from following their pleasure mechanisms. The headman, then, is definitely a higher level. He is an evaluator, a man, but an evaluator of power. He can see that if you can inhibit your reaction to pleasure and pain, you can actually control the situation better. And the control is symbolized in the hedge or ladder. Above the level of this headman, because he is an individual who has the power to dictate to the herd, there is another force. This force is the E force, and we're using E to symbolize universal energy, E for energy. Now, as you know, energy means a cause of change locked up in work. Energy is the capacity for doing work. And when we use this letter E, we are using it as in the expression E equals mc squared. We're using it for energy, even all about that one. And it means universal energy. Now, we've got a circle down here for the K fellow, because he's a nice closed circle. We have another circle for the S man, and we have another circle for the universal. And we have one down below for the gross material. We'll square the one up at the bottom and shade it off to represent that the earth is like building blocks. And then we'll run the other circles together in this manner. These are living processes. And we now have a being with life force utilizing a physical body with the power to inhibit itself and to compel itself to move towards painful situations. And above it, we have another kind of man who says you should not, you ought not, you must not push other people about for your own individual ends, because there is a universal purpose. Now, the headmen are the great heroes. Alexander the Great, Napoleon, Hitler, Mussolini. Those are getting a bit small, those big men. And they push the world about and all the biological beings about for their own individual purposes. But above them, there are some other men who say, we know from our personal experience, because we've tried it for thousands of years, that you can't win pushing people about, because there is another purpose above individuals duping each other. There is a universal purpose. And this is represented by the E level, universal energy. And this person is aware that even a Hitler cannot defeat gravity. He must obey that law. Even Napoleon could not defeat the Russian snow. We know from physical science's efforts that it's trying to beat interplanetary space, and that it has a sort of pipe dream of getting outside the solar system. And the more enlightened astronomers know that the nearest stars are so far away that if we were to try to travel there, we would be dead before we got 1/1,000,000th of the way towards them. So that whatever our intention is to be when we get there, we will not realize it. And these are called the enlightened space travelers, who say, let's confine ourselves to the solar system this year. Now, we can call these the universalists, who say, there is a law actually the Archbishop is supposed to represent this universal thing. He is supposed to tell the military leader what is not to be done because it's not allowed in the universal terms. And the man with universal consciousness never encourages headmen, hedge makers, to dupe people too often, too long, or to the point of their ultimate destruction. He has a little handbook, and in this handbook, which is called Babel, or Confusion, the old Babylonian world translated into the word Bible, in this handbook it says, the ox shall be allowed to eat of the corn that falls on the threshing floor. Otherwise, the ox will not be able to keep turning the wheel that works the lever that makes the thing that thrashes the corn go. Now, the people at the level of the life force in that book are referred to as oxen. And the headmen above them, the Herods, and the Ashur Bounty Pals, and the great men of old, they ordered these oxen about simply because they were determined by pleasure pain only. They could sell fairly fast to them. And they did so. But over and above these were the astronomers, the Chaldean priest astronomers, who said to the headmen of their day, if you destroy all these people, they can't work for you. It isn't logical to destroy all your own workers. And they said, instead of hitting people with the edge of the sword, which tends to open the integument to let the blood out and allow them to die, you can get a far better effect by hitting them with the flat of the sword. It makes more noise. It is more frightening, and it is not lethal. And therefore, if you read the Bible carefully, you will find sometimes it says, and they put them to the edge of the sword. And at other times it says, and they put them to the flat of the sword, and then they were able to pay taxes later. This is a very important thing. The universalist says you can't destroy all these inferior beings without exposing yourself to the possibility of having to do your own dirty work. So only kill them in sufficient numbers not to deprive yourself of oxen. And this is the universal level. This is why, of course, Archbishop Ramsay could say we may have to use force in Rhodesia. In fact, we ought to, if necessary. Because he's seeing that the headmen might actually start banging about and polishing people off. And as the British undoubtedly wish to keep a foot in Africa on certain territories, they really think that Smith is quite a nice fellow. But they don't want him to mishandle the situation so badly that there's a wholesale invasion of Africans into Rhodesia who might tip out the only foothold apart from South Africa that the British have got left worth keeping. And the Archbishop, who knows these rules, says, well now, if I go on the side of threatened violence, this will make all the people that want violence in this country think they have a representative in me. And I'm sticking my neck out because I represent Jesus Christ, who wouldn't have used this kind of sword. But then he says, I'm not using the kind of sword they are thinking of, I'm only using the one that Christ recommended, that is the sword of the mouth. And if I can persuade somebody by threat of violence to behave as if violence had been done, it's more economic. So the function of the archbishops, of the leaders of the church, the left arm of the state, is to make universal pronouncements of what is and is not possible. And when we go into the level above it, you remember, that represented Allah on the absolute level, and therefore we're not allowed to draw a circle outside it, so we'll draw a half circle to remind you to think about the other half we haven't drawn. Now the other half of this circle, the half we haven't drawn, is infinite. And the half we have drawn is there to remind us of the infinite. So we now have five levels of being. And we see a very peculiar thing. At the Aleph level, we are dealing with an infinite force, with a very high frequency vibration, and this infinite force absolutely permeates all lower levels, all lower frequencies and conditions their functioning, their activity. So the absolute infinite there has created for itself an object. That unit is the world. Therefore, all the great religions and philosophies say the world is an objective presentation of an infinite force. It is the infinite sentient power's method of objectifying its own potentiality. It comes out of the infinite and turns round and makes a circle. Then it goes down and makes another circle. And then it goes down and makes another, and then it makes another. And the bottom one, the weight is so heavy on it, it flattens it and makes a brick out of it for standing upon. Therefore it says, and the earth is God's footstool. Now we're going to see what happens. At the Aleph level, the frequency, very, very fast, travelling through infinite space in all directions, is making a very fine vibrational mesh. This very fine vibrational mesh contains all the forms that later, by progressive suppression, become lower levels of being. So within this absolute vibration we have a mesh of frequencies, and as you can see from this particular little mesh I've drawn, if we don't superstress any part of it, the whole of the mesh is identical throughout itself, so that any given part of that mesh is the same as another part, and therefore there is no hierarchy there, no differentiation, no superior and inferior functions. But when we take that mesh and decide to superstress a part of it, that is just to compress, to begin to inhibit its motion, we create a little form. Now, create does not mean to bring something new into being. It means to compress and to inhibit that which is already inherent in the absolute motion. So when we think about consciousness and its objects, consciousness and its content, we can look upon consciousness in two totally different ways. One, the absolute way. The absolute contains in its vibrational pattern all conceivable forms of every level that can be superstressed within it. The method of superstressing is by simply pressing onto a particular zone and thus inhibiting the motion. When you inhibit it, you slow the frequency down and wrench out of its context whatever little part of it you have superstressed. In this case, I've got a sort of not very good diamond-shaped superstress. It is not a new shape. It is an eternal shape, but now inhibiting, it is wrenched, apparently, out of its context. Now, as soon as we come into the level of superstress, we have changed our mode of functioning. When we superstress, the eye focuses upon the superstressed objective form. Objective means we can go round it. The ob, an object, is the same word as the word orb in its original. The word orb means a sphere, something we can circumscribe. So if we say, all right, let's circumscribe the square, let's circumscribe a triangle, let's circumscribe a circle. When we do this, we inhibit the free vibration of the absolute and produce a localized slowing down and therefore an increase of density, an increase of inertia in the form. And when we do this, now when we perceive it, we are forced to look from one thing to another. So that if I put a triangle and the square and the circle and the crescent and so on, it's a weird crescent, it's a bit like a banana. And when I do this, the fact of circumscription within consciousness, if we are not careful, that is, if we are functioning at any level below our level, if we are not careful, we will look at this object, and in so doing, we will lose the consciousness of the surrounding field. And when we look at this triangle, for a moment, this crescent banana is out of focus. I'll separate them out for you. If I put a square over there and a triangle over there, because you're further away than I am, you look at the square and you can feel in your eyes a focusing, a movement, to focus that square. This triangle will be on the perimeter of your awareness when the square is in the center of your awareness. And in order to get from the square to the triangle, you'll have to allow the square to lose focal clarity, and you will take time to get across the intervening space and focus on this triangle. So in this peculiar mode of awareness, the serial mode, we say serial because we're taking things in a series, one by one, in this mode, every time we focus on an object, we have unfocus on another object. And therefore we're seeing the world in a very peculiar way. We're seeing it in the way of the intellectual materialistic scientist. Now the lower intellect is concerned with form of the serial order. Intellect is that part in us which enables us to see the formal means to the realization of a purpose. The tell in intellect is from a word meaning purpose. The lect part is the same as read and so on. So when we think of intellect, we are thinking of the means of realization of a purpose. And when we think of the lower intellect, I shouldn't really draw that square up in the absolute, in isolation. I should draw the mesh in so that you can forget it again. And same with this triangle. When we focus, we unfocus on the rest. And as soon as we focus on one form, our mind goes into a state of identification with that form, which is a basic thing, psychologically, that to become conscious of an object, we have to force the mind energy, because mind is energy, to run round the form. In the case of the square, it runs round it on four sides, and it has a little quantum kick on the corners, a little feeling of flick in the eye. I draw a very big square like this, and you follow it round with your eye. At the corners, you will find that you have to expend a little bit of energy to change direction. You can't run round it in the same ease that you can round a circle with your eye. As you follow the straight line up, when you come to the corner, there will be a flick of energy which you can feel if you're observing yourself, and you have to use energy to change direction, and the same again. So it's harder for you to follow the square than it is to follow the circle. But when you take a form out of the infinite field of vibration and focus on it, you superstress it and you inhibit that energy. And in the process you force the mind into a state of identification with the object. Now, if you identify your mind with an object, you become in your imagination the object. And if when you are enjoying this object, supposing it's a beautiful statue, imagine for a moment somebody goes to see Michelangelo's Pietà, and they see this beautiful figure of Christ on Mary's knees, and they are gazing on this form with a crowd of people, and a man comes up, rather weird looking man, and he suddenly takes out from underneath his coat a hammer and knocks one of the hands off it. And what would happen to all the people who had gone to see this? Some from America, some from Russia, some from China. They've come from all over the world to see this perfect object, the product of genius. And then some nut comes along, or maybe he's a sage trying to break them of identifying with external objects. But he knocks the hand off it. Everybody goes, at the moment they were looking at that thing of beauty, their mind energy had assumed the form. And the more beautiful it is, the more overpowering is its perfection, the more the identification occurs. And when the identification occurs, if at that moment this object is smashed, it feels to the identified person as if they too are smashed. They feel the blow. There aren't many normal mothers that can see their child climb on the top of a chair and fall down onto its head on the tiled floor without feeling a funny sensation in their own heads. And this tendency to identify with a beloved object
is a natural tendency because of the identity of all beings in the absolute field. And it is also a very dangerous tendency because the men on the Golden Mile can present you with a gold-plated super-beauty with which you will identify in a mock-up shoot. You can take it home and find that when you've got it home, the gold plate peeled off because it was vacuum deposited. And accidentally, you shook it, so all the gold fell off. It's a very, very fine film, actually. Now, here we have a statement of two totally different kinds of awareness. The serial awareness that we use ordinarily, in ordinary thinking, is so common that most people don't think there's any other way of thinking. They think that if I want to see all the people in this room, I'll have to go around like this and look at each one. But in actual fact, we don't do any such thing at another level. You know very well that if you ask yourself what you know in this room now, the first thing you know is the totality of the room. And without any specific detail, you know that it's full of people without focusing on any given one of them. So if I look at the point on the light in the center, and that's my focal center, I can see quite clearly that I'm also aware of the totality of people in the room and other objects. So actually, we always have a whole consciousness, and we tend within this whole to focus on a particular bit, the bit that interests us. Now the bit that interests us is the bit that we have responded to because we can assimilate the stimulus from it, comfortably within our pattern. And as soon as we find something giving us pleasure, we tend to identify, to allow the mind energy to assume the form of this pleasant stimulating object. But as soon as we become identified with the object, and if one of these funny sages trying to cure us of identification comes in and hits Tom the head, as soon as this happens, we are distressed. Now, all mental disorders of whatever kind are simply a product of this primary fact that human beings tend to identify their own energy with the form of the beloved object. And then as soon as the form is distorted or destroyed or taken away, it appears to this identified being that their own life energy has been destroyed or distorted or taken away. And until they can learn that this is not so, then there is bound to be a suffering process. Now let's compare the two. The serial process of perceiving objects separately takes time, so that if I look at my fingers, five of them, close up, I see little finger, ring finger, middle, index, thumb. That takes me 5 seconds to look at those fingers. Now if I remove them to a greater distance, I can see them in 1 second. So that if I remove myself to an infinite distance, I shall see them in no time at all. Now seeing a thing in no time at all is the same thing as seeing them eternally. Eternity means no time at all. Actually the word eternity comes from root concept meaning threefold power. Threefold because power always has three aspects. It appears as a cause of change, it appears as a form, and it is sentient. It feels itself. So therefore eternity should be translated a trinity, that is, threefold power. Now, in the absolute, the mode of perception is eternal, and that means non-temporal, non-serial. We can do it in part here very simply by not focusing on any particular point in the room, but by allowing our mind energy to identify with the whole room. Forget the roar of the traffic for a moment, passing down Chester Road, that is if you were remembering it, but feel the whole content of this room as one whole energy vibrating in different ways. If you do this experiment sincerely, you will find that it's perfectly true. If you focus in one corner of the room, roughly over the area of perhaps a dozen people, and then shift your focus to another corner of the room, and simultaneously watch your feeling, you will find a definite feeling change occurs. That you are not feeling in the four corners of this room in the same way. Now, most of you have met each other before to some degree of familiarity, and therefore, if you allow your consciousness to focus, you will begin to wrench out of the total awareness of this room a specific form and a specific reaction. If you focus on a group of people that you know, you have a different feeling from if you focus on a group of people you don't know. And if within the group you do know, you focus down to individuals, you will find again that not only is your formal content changing, but your affective reaction, that is your feeling response, is also changing. And with this feeling response, your impulse to action is changing. So here we have two totally different modes. The mode of the absolute eternal and the mode of the temporal serial. And when we do things temporally and serially, we become very, very clear about the individual part. If I look at Johnny Guitar from here and focus on his hair, which is very dark, and then I focus on Donald next to him, his hair is not as dark as Johnny's. And as I look at the two and feel in myself, I feel two quite different responses. First of all, I feel a different racial response. Inside me, I have a certain biological origin, and I see a coloration in Johnny belonging to my mother's side of the family, and I see a coloration in Donald rather similar to one of my father's cousins. And this echoes inside me. Ordinarily, it would be what is called unconscious, that is superconscious, if I didn't focus on it. But when I look at these two beings, I get a different emotional response. And therefore, if I feel, emotion means my feeling is moving out, it is moving out in a slightly different way to these two beings. And if I focus on Johnny, then I get one feeling and impulse and form. He has a form. When I take in the form, it gives me a certain kind of feeling. And with this feeling, a tendency to action, the feeling becomes emotive, and this becomes cognitive. We have a drive. If I look at Donald, I immediately start thinking of funny sketches of Parsons. And if I look at Johnny, I think of the guitar and various Spanish things that he's played. So my affect, my emotive response to these two beings is quite different. But if I focus on both of them at once and refuse to allow consciousness to cut down to either, then I get a sort of funny thing of a parson playing the Spanish guitar. And out of this overlapping comes a peculiar thing, a movement towards universal entropy. But if I allow this to happen with all the people I know here, if I now move to our resident clown and see him on the monocycle, and I add to him the parson that Donald guides and the guitar, so now I've got a parson playing a guitar on the top of a monocycle, wedged with his head against the ceiling. I have put together three different forms, produced three different affective responses, and three different emotive tendencies to compel my body to do something about it. When I put them all together, I feel I ought to go and pull the wheel out from underneath the monocycle. Now, if I allow these responses, you can see they contradict each other. I know that when John plays his guitar, he has a low little stool. Not a fun little stool. Nobody knows what it's for unless they see it in operation. They think it's for a Manx fairy. And I know that that little stool, which is a few inches in area, perhaps 5 by 8, that little stool would be rather difficult to balance upon with the monocycle, whilst at the same time Donald is identified with the same thing, with a flowing scarf doing the parson that he calls sporting parson, who is rather energetic. and I sincerely doubt the possibility of a peddler getting up there, playing the guitar, and simultaneously doing Donald's Sporting Parson without coming off that little stool. So when we see this, it stabilizes the mind in a peculiar way. Stabilize means that these different forms inhibit each other in certain ways. Now I know that if I have to do this with everybody in the room, I react differently to each person. I see a different form, get a different feeling response, a different emotive tendency to action, a culmination. And if I put them all together, I know what will happen to me. I shall not be able to move. Because all these different things cannot be done simultaneously. Now imagine we do this, and we include not only the people in this room, but all the people in the world. Just under about 3,000 million of them. So I identify with all these different types. And regardful of race, color, and creed, I deliberately hold myself identified with all of them. Now if I do this thoroughly and extend it to the solar system and the sidereal system, I have to identify with people lost in space as well. And when I do this, I become completely immobilized. I'm a mass of contradictions. So if I do this and carry this identification right out, including the Earth, all the planets, the solar system, the sidereal system, any systems, whatever they are, and I deliberately identify with the totality of these, I launch myself into identification with the Absolute, and when I do that, I do exactly what God does, namely nothing. Now because he is, in this sense, completely negated by his own absolute potentialities, therefore, he would have been stuck in absolute non-being if he allowed this state to continue. And therefore, all the great religions say, therefore God created. Now created means arced, circumscribed, inhibited. He stops this simultaneous absolute awareness and localizes, focuses on particulars. And then he develops by focusing on one zone, relax, focus on the next zone, relax, focus on the next zone. And this focusing on a zone and then relaxing